Hey, what's up, guys? This is Lucas Burnley. You are listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm here with my co-host, TJ Schwartz. How's it going, TJ?
Going real well. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, man. Are you guys going trick-or-treating?
Of course. Yeah, we
Yeah.
were
We
up last
got
night building costumes. So
nice, man. Yeah, we
yeah.
got there's big game strategy tonight.
Aha.
Neighborhood talks.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Oh yeah, big game. All right, guys. So TJ and I are kind of trying to figure out where to like pick up this conversation that we've been having offline, which feels seasonal. It's kind of coming into the, like end of the year, and we are just recapping kind of changes we're seeing in the industry, trends we're seeing, how that relates to us, and like the business in general. This is the kind of stuff that we're always kind of mulling over. But we realize that TJ has like a pretty solid project that he's working on that ties really well into some of these concepts. Do you want to just like, give people a little insight?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sweet.
Yes. Yeah, we've been making knives in our own manufacturing processes since 2021 or so. Had a lot of fun with it, but they all are missing something, which is a seam in the middle, which allows them to fold. And so we're working on just such a thing right now, which I
So
am excited for.
you, yeah, this is a big one. Well, and it's funny watching it come from like production side, because it is almost the same process as most guys in the custom side start with fixed blades and then move into folders. I would argue that you actually were backwards because you were designing folders for so long, but that wasn't the product that you started building. Right. So you are coming around and you are in the process of developing a folder for your own production now.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Yeah, it's going good. I thought when I bought the Tormach machine, which is 5 years ago exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, 5 years that I threw a machine in the garage, and it took me a year to really get fixed blades off the ground just because I had no idea how to run the thing and built a lot of miscellaneous stuff and build up to that. But I thought I would be on to folders immediately. I thought I was like, okay, I'm going to convert a folder design into the Overland, because it just seemed natural. It was kind of a popular design in the folder space that I had. And I thought, well, I'll make like some of these, and then I'm going to just start figuring out how this folder thing is going to happen. And I even had like a few 3D prints of folders that were kind of on deck. And holy cow, 4 years later, I basically disappeared. The folder disappeared from my whole vision for 3, 4 years as I just realized that fixed blades were a lot of fun. I really liked them. I liked making them. People liked them. There was a bigger market than what I thought. We were able to scale the business way further. It's just a more core pillar of the business than I ever thought it would be, which is just
Yeah.
the high-end fixed blades. And so now there's a part of me that's like feels, maybe it's in a personal way, maybe it's in a business way, but like it almost feels like I'm endangering some stagnation in life in general. And it's
Right.
like I just want to get a hold of something like special again. You know what I mean? I want to, because the
Yeah.
fixed blade felt that way. Because to a
Right.
lot of people, it's simple, but like to spin up the manufacturing for them was kind of like the project of a lifetime to start manufacturing, right?
Right.
But now it's stabilized, and I've realized I'm kind of wanting for that next thread.
Yeah, that you and I talk about this a lot, like that desire for like development or like a little bit of push. Again, it's in our namesake, like Edge and Flow. Like you have always sought to kind of like push past. It seems like with the fixed blade production method, you have probably pushed that close to the edge of like where you need to take it. Like you are freaking efficient, right? At this point, anything that you could do would be very minor time changes, probably, or improvements, or like scale, like actually scaling to some different level that is not necessarily the goal.
Yeah.
Right. So does that, do you think that you like sensed that coming and that is where the folder like kind of came back in? Because we've talked about it over like the last few years and you were just kind of like never like, no, it's not, I'm not like working on a folder. I don't have like, that's not the goal.
Yeah.
So something shifted.
Yeah. So to be frank, it's like when we are to the point of diminishing returns with developing our process. Granted, the ceiling is way higher than where we are in all ways, efficiency and all that. You know, I got a nod to like some of these to companies that obviously have efficiency a million light years ahead of where we are. But for the like price point and the quality that we're after and like the scale of the business and where we fit in the market, like we are in the point of diminishing returns where to the point where it's like the problems that I face with production are things like how do we, like the biggest one right now is how do we more efficiently change our filter paper on the grinding machine? How do we, how do, yeah, how do we manage coolant life better? How do we, you know, keep, and it's stuff like that that it matters a whole lot. It's like production engineering, right? Some eventually you get to a scale where those things actually matter a lot. They start to become a big deal. But it's kind of evidence of the fact that I've kind of zoomed and zoomed and zoomed on this process, which has been good. But now I've gone down this rabbit hole to the point where it doesn't feel like I'm seeing a big picture anymore. It feels like it's the tiniest of details, which is good. But there's a part of me that I think was is just from a mental standpoint that's missing like some kind of big picture head on a swivel. Okay, I don't know what this is going to do because it's like if we develop a folder, we're going to need some sort of other equipment. We're going to need some sort of other processes. Don't know what that looks like yet. We'll just solve them one at a time, which takes me back to the way it felt with the fixed blade in the beginning. You know what
Which
I
is
mean?
there's different types of problem solving, right? That type is that's like my sweet spot. I basically struggle past that point. Like for me, the consistency around even getting to a point where I'm really refining fixtures or a process, I notice that I struggle. But in the initial stages, it's like I can't turn it off, right? So it's like that prototyping stage all out of, but a lot of that is around like the physical and mechanical design of the thing. So yeah, man, it makes perfect sense because I mean, at this point, I guess like a decent example would be that like at this point, if you wanted to add another fixed blade, there isn't the problem solving component that you might enjoy from a product development, view. Like you could basically just, okay, we know this process, we know how we grind blades, we know like our outsourced flow, right? So you might be switching it out, but it's not like new.
And it's if one of the things I told the guys is I was like, I wanted to be in part a mature enough company to do a folder the right way. And so part of that meaning having some staff, having processes like bevel grinding. We still have to do bevel grinding. We still have to do heat treat. We still have to do surface grinding. We still have to do all the things that are required to make a blade, right? That's universal across an Overland Sport or a new folding knife. And so it's like we now can focus on the things that are specifically unique about folders and kind of not worry too much. The bevel grinding is sort of a non-issue, right? And that's different than if we'd started with the folder in the beginning where the bevel grinding is all the issue, right? And so we now can focus on like the minutia of a folder with more precision, I guess. And so I like that. I like the trajectory we're on quite a bit in that regard. But yeah, 5 years of working on the most efficient way to make a fixed blade is productive, but there's a point where it's like, I don't know if I could do 5 more years of that. You know what I mean?
I dude, I think it is interesting because the like making learning techniques and making like universally, I think you're better off starting with the simpler, more simple form, right? So you were able to learn and refine on fixed blades, processes that would have been more complicated based on some of the other details around folders. You're just like, you're just like tolerant stacking and like building in unnecessary complexity. We had like a similar kind of realization recently. So Levi is starting to run the laser, right? Which means that he is learning Illustrator. This is something that I've never actually learned. Like I hacked together my laser graphics in the software and we realized like, okay, to do more, we have to learn a process that is like more, not necessarily efficient, but like more flexible. So you talk about robust CAD, right? And in the way that we build our models as being robust. What I'm seeing is for us to build graphics, we have to have that same level of control. So like an example would be if we want to laser a rose on something and change the size, we have to be able to also change like the line width and proportion and have that graphic maintain like visual, you know, scale. Without having like a good knowledge of Illustrator, it's actually really hard.
Yeah. But you have to have a best, sort of a pattern of workflow or kind of even a lookbook. Like I've heard you talk about that before, where it's like, this is our architecture for our aesthetic. This is how it fits
in, right? Like, oh, is it like we were messing around with it. And it's like, okay, this rose. Okay, great. We got the graphic to like come out. We can laser it. It's like the right DP, all this stuff, but it's like super chunky. Right. The line's too thick because we scaled it up. It's just like little things. And anybody who's listening that like has a background in Illustrator, like I'm sure you're chuckling because this is easy stuff, but it's not easy if you don't know the software at all. But this is a great example because it's like, okay, I might go grab a graphic that someone else that like Joey's done or something, it's the dialed. And if we're trying to recreate that, it's harder than just trying to make a circle and then change the line width and add a fill and like, okay, we're going to do two circles and overlap them so we can have different layers for laser settings. The circle gets you to the same point without any of the confusion of like, ooh, did I just like drag that like corner or like what, what am I like, okay, oh, I'm on the wrong layer. It's like you start at the beginning, you put in the one block, you just build from that point forward. So I think on the custom side, we see it with fixed blades. You're doing that, right? You're building all the basic skills. Can you grind a blade?
Right.
There is a point for most knife makers where blade grinding is maybe the most stressful part. You get to a point where like you can grind a blade with your eyes shut almost.
Same with sharpening.
Blocks is the hard part.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you're learning to grind blades and fit locks and set detents and like all these other little like fiddly bits, it just makes it, the whole process slows down.
Yeah. It's just Stack Overflow at that point.
Yeah. You just can't, you're learning too much.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're at a point now where it's like the specificity of a folder isn't stacking on the specificity of machining, blade grinding, and like overall process of production.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Pretty exciting.
That is exciting. Yeah. We moved along quite a way. I built a blade fixture this last week, made a blade. It's going to heat treat. I've made scales in a prototype manner with the old slot and tab technique.
Okay.
And so we're building production fixtures here. The biggest thing with a folder, this is the hardest part for us, is we have to source round parts.
Right.
And that's not hard to do. Like Swiss lathe shops exist, right? But it's totally antithetical to how we've operated.
Right.
Which is, we don't buy custom parts from anybody. If something's custom, we're making it.
Right.
And so we have like our whole Kanban system where we have like, okay, our screws, we order a small amount of them. We run out, we order another small amount. Right. Everything's like small scale, like small ball. So if we do a new fixed blade, the overall planning is lower because it's sort of like we already have this flow of parts.
Yeah.
But with a fit with a folder, you end up with like, okay, weird let's say that you have standoffs in the back
right.
or something like that. It's like, well,
something, yeah, something that you're having produced by another shop, but to an almost finished level. For I mean, dude, for instance, we use tie connector screws for our Kihoku, but I use a custom length.
Yep.
So I give myself a 3 month lead time.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally the only Kanban card I have right now.
Yeah.
But the stakes are so high.
Yeah.
That I know that if I get over my skis and forget to order screws, there's a very real potential that we can't get them for like a quarter.
Yeah.
Unacceptable.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course. So, yeah. And that's,
so you're starting to deal with that.
So we're starting to deal with that where like the minimums, I would say on a custom part like that, on a Swiss lathe part, they're affordable. The machines are great. They're precise, but they have high minimums because the setup on a Swiss lathe is so in depth compared to like a mill. So they have high minimums. So it's like, you have to think about how are we going to flow that into our process?
Yeah.
And like, you kind of have to have a bit of, you know, balls, if you want to call it that, to like, okay, we want to start making these. We're going to have to get thousands of parts moving to make the first run. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you can't just buy 10 of them, you know, and it's just not
even
really
to prototype.
Works.
Well, and this is, I guess this is the thing, right? Like custom would be like, okay, you're developing something, you might modify another part, or you're buying an off the shelf could still be like tie connector, right? Like we're using an off the shelf pivot, or you're modifying something. But yeah, by the time you're into a real order of parts, so just out of curiosity, have you gone through the Swiss lathe shop flow yet?
No, we haven't had. So I had some prototype parts made by Xometry, a Xometry vendor, because I wanted to test geometry before I went and got like a big shop on board to make, you know, real volume.
Which and that was affordable. There's a couple things that tie in here. The big one that I was thinking was I wanted to like talk about like the cash flow side, which is interesting because I don't think you've had it, but keep going on the Xometry. So Xometry made like a batch of prototype parts.
Yeah, like three parts.
Whoa.
And so these parts are like $200 each.
Okay.
And so that's what you're looking at to have like precision Swiss lathe parts that are in low quantity is like ungodly prices. I mean, we're talking a tiny part that's less than a half inch long that's $200 each, right? And so, but you have to do it. You just kind of have to. So we've done that. And so now it's like, I'm basically right now, the phase I'm in is like combing this design and getting ready. Like I have a list in front of me. The next thing to do, the very first one is order hardware, like officially order hardware.
Yeah.
And I have like this fear over it because I'm like, it better be right. You know what I mean? So I'm in that mode of just double, triple checking, quadruple checking, making sure, because the way production seems to work in the companies I've been around making folders is like, you get the hardware first.
Yeah.
And you start making parts and making sure the hardware fits, not the other way around.
You don't make the part. Yeah. You don't make the part to the hardware.
Yeah.
Or you do actually.
Yeah.
But you don't make the part assuming the hardware is a natural fit.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because if you have the hardware sitting in a bag and you have the mill running in front of you, you can check parts. You can pull randomly. You can check things. You can assemble one. Okay. Yeah. That actually doesn't work. I have control over the parts coming out of my own mill, right?
Right.
If you're like, okay, I ordered parts from a Swiss shop, it's going to be 60 days. We're going to build all the frames and all the whatever in the meantime, and when they get here, we're going to start assembling. That is a train wreck coming. Like I've seen it happen quite a few times with just being around other companies and stuff, and because you can have tolerances be on, but you just never know. And here's the problem. Let's say the hardware, let's say you have a pivot come in oversized. Let's say it's a thou over tolerance.
Yeah.
Whoops. Cool. You could talk to the shop. If you had a good print, they could remake them. Are you going to wait 60 days?
Yeah.
No, you're going to buy a different size reamer and you're going to make that knife. Right. So that's the thing. And that's where for this to progress, I've got to get the hardware ordered soon. But I will admit it's like, there's a little bit of a nervous reaction to the thought of
is the
thousands.
Number is the number high enough that it like is a risk?
It's less monetary, it's more if it's more just making 100% positive, I'm not going to change this design to the extent that this goes from we're going to be making these in 2 months to 6 months.
Dude,
You know what I mean?
this is the thing that I have struggled with more than any other aspect of the production concept, because I am so used to being able to make just small changes that by the time that you're locked in, it feels like I'm like, oh man, I have to like really like that. And I have to be really okay with where we're at. And for me, I'm so slow. Like I just chew on details, which in general, I think is a strength, but it's not a strength in like making final decisions in a reasonable amount of time to be like, this is the end result.
And I struggle with that quite a bit. It's like when you come up against a big decision, I may chew on it for too long, overthink it or whatever. It's like probably, I mean, I'm talking myself into just getting some hardware ordered done this call, but it's stuck in my own head looking at the SolidWorks, looking at the spinning the model around. I'm like, you know, like I love the design, but it's like, okay, should that have been a 5 thou clearance there or 10? It's
Yeah, this
like, you
is,
know what I mean?
there are no small details, you know? Guys, I've seen the folder. And it is TJ level as to be expected, but dude, it's sick. I told you like right away, like I would carry the hell out of that thing. It's gonna be
Well, thank you.
very solid.
Thank
Yeah.
you.
Dude, do you have a deal? It's like any kind of rough timeline
So
or
we are
goal internal?
we can make blades in a production way pretty much already. Scales, I need to build a fixture for, that's pretty dang easy. It's all going to come down to the hardware being right the first time and how long the lead time on that is. I don't know yet. But I'd like to think we're within a few months.
Couple of few months. Do you do? I feel like I know your answer. Are you going to do a show release for it, do you think? Or would you just do like online?
Definitely start online only because there isn't a show plus or
That's going to
minus
line up.
anywhere close. Yeah. Because I'm thinking like we're talking like January here and it's.
Maybe a CCKS. I think somebody told me maybe that it's not happening in February, but CCKS would be actually a sick show to release at if it was like a February availability.
Yeah.
The
That could be
California
cool.
guys and that in like just the market would be like a very fun place to do it. Okay, so this like swing back around a little bit, like where this tied into our conversation around the industry, right? And just like I don't know, our businesses and like the market in general was probably what, like around diversification. So for you right now, you are kind of like single product line, not single product, but like fixed blades of a general size range and aesthetic.
For sure.
Okay. Going to a folder is a diversification that is inside, it's like inside of the envelope of knife making, obviously, inside of your current customer base, probably, right? You are more likely, I think, to have folder or fixed blade buyers buy folders than the other way around,
Yeah, agreed.
right? So, but you will also really expand past your current audience by adding a folder. Right.
I mean, I don't know what the number is, but I have to think that there's 20 guys wanting to buy a folder for every 20 people wanting to buy a folder for every one wanting to buy a fixed blade. As a
I
holistic view of knife purchasing,
of knife purchasing.
yeah, because
Dude, I
I
wouldn't
mean,
even be surprised if it was more.
yeah, it might
And
be 50-1. I don't
yeah, and
know.
we say this again as fixed blade guys. And at a time where fixed blades, I think, actually are performing better than in like the last couple, you know, periods without pockets in like the last couple decades as a whole in the industry. Right. And I think a lot of that, I think fixed blades had a resurgence because of neck knives which led to in-pocket fixed blades.
Yeah, the in-pocket. Yeah.
Right? I think the in-pocket thing reminded people how cool fixed blades were. And then, like, you go up in size a little bit, and then it's like, oh, like, people, there's always people that love fixed blades and will buy a big hunting knife or a big field knife. But I think overall as a market, we're seeing, like,
it's
more of a trend.
Yeah. Yeah. It's grown, but you can't deny it's still a niche. Cause no. I mean, if you go walk down the street and with, you know, like a TikToker with a microphone, you say, do you have a knife on you?
Yeah.
If you find 10 guys, none of them have a fixed blade, guarantee it. You know what
it
I mean?
It is, like, it is like very rare.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, man. So, well, and I think you can stop me if I've talked about this story or like talked about it recently, but so I made fixed blades exclusively for like the first 7 or 8 years. Okay. When I started making folders, it was so involved that basically I stopped making fixed blades. I couldn't manage both things. And at this point, everything is fully handmade. Everything is just me working on one piece or three pieces at a time. And started making folders. And my market just like blew up, right? Mm-hmm. Demand went crazy. And it wasn't until much later that I realized I was like not seeing like what I would consider like legacy customers.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who bought something every time I released a model, they bought something at every show. It wasn't until years later that I actually stopped seeing probably 50% of those names. But the folder demand was so high that like overall customer base just like shot up. So you don't feel it. It's a really interesting transition.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and I'm curious what this means for fixed blades, because I love fixed blades. I carry fixed blades all the time.
Yeah.
And I think they're great, but we were talking before the podcast, like I almost am proceeding with caution.
Right.
Because I can imagine the thick folder just gobbling up my whole attention span.
Right.
And fixed blades just falling off. And it's a niche, but it's like we kind of are prominent in that niche. And it's like, we don't want to like just ditch our role there. You know what I mean? That's not ideal. So,
well, and I think the lesson for me was it was unavoidable at the time that I did it. But at this point for you, you'll be able to maintain, like you can make the choice to still make fixed blades,
mm-hmm.
right? You're not going to just like cut and run.
Right.
It might pull a little bit of focus, but I actually think that's a really, really good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have to let products breathe a little bit. Sometimes it's nice to like be able to let people shift off the focus or for you to shift your focus.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, the ideal scenario is like, you don't look at it like, oh, I can make folders and now I don't need to make fixed blades, which you wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of maintaining your brand and like your current customers while it being able to like expand your production, your skill set, and like reach new customers also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
And the other question that is sort of paramount is, are we going to use the folder to scale?
Ooh.
Or are we going to use it to reinforce what we already have? You know what I mean? Because it's like, you can, if you bring out a new product line, you can try to squeeze every last drop out of your old products and take the new one as far as you can go with it. Or you can look at what you're doing, and this is a rare thing to do, but it's something I'm considering, which is like have an idea for a size of a company or a size of a operation, a number of employees, or like an amount of overhead that it's like, or a number of knives or whatever the, you know, sort of vibe is. It's like, this is how big I like this company to be because of what it means for my lifestyle or what it means for whatever. And then you could say, if I have a folder in there, it could just make that more bulletproof, right? Because it's like now we have another set of eyes with folder buyers looking at our brand and wanting to buy our stuff. But we're not just going to scale to meet that demand and then be back to that same position. There's a part of me that wants to do that as opposed to
Right.
try to squeeze folders for everything they're worth as well. You know what I mean?
That's my gut is like I like to let things take time, and and kind of just like grow organically. And we have, I mean, over the years, we've had a lot of products where I could have turned on the tap for a period and really probably just cranked. Initially, it was through the inability to really be able to make those big decisions or like capital outlays. But I realized over time that it also suited my way of doing business, which is like I like consistency and I like long game. And so, you know, we were talking about before we started recording, we did a SIPOP drop yesterday and it was, I think, 38 seconds. And the SIPOP is what are we on now? 13 years old. To me, that is important to me.
Yeah, how different would this would your position right now be if you'd bought like two or three Haas machines in 2011 and just put, 80 a fixture that holds 80 SIPOPs and you've gotten, 600 of them a day coming out. It's like it'd be different, you know what I mean? It'd be different.
And not to say that it would be worse or that it would have failed. I think, and this is something that I have to realize because I can be kind of like black and white in my metrics, but it would have been different. Maybe you look and you're like, well, yeah, okay. It would have never built the level of like following that it has, or like, you know, specialness, I guess, maybe for lack of a better word. But I would have sold more parts. Right. And so I think I think you just we're constantly doing these evaluations around what we want out of our product, what we want for our customers, what we want out of our customers, what our interactions are. And that is, I think a lot of that goes towards that like concept of scale or not like scarcity, I guess, but just like, dude, I don't want to spend all my time making SIPOPs, but I love making them. I kind of know where I like to be. So do folders like kind of fill that same space for you?
Yeah, totally. And that's a thing that I think is not discussed, which I'm glad we kind of got to this on this podcast because it's kind of the core, which is that when I look at the business that I'm building, probably the paramount thing is what do I actually want to be doing, me personally? Because if I build a business where the result is I'm doing stuff I don't like, then is a it was a the whole thing's pointless at that point because that's the paramount thing. Because if you look at things from its from a standpoint of scaling, then very quickly you're going to be like, okay, the things that need to happen are things I don't like to do. And you're going to get entrenched in this other route, this other pathway of thinking about the business, which I have done before. You know what I mean? And so I'm familiar with that trench. And so with this, it's like, does making a folder sound fun? Yes, it does. Does managing someday, 50 employees sound fun? I don't think so. You know what I mean? For me personally,
Not for you
not knocking
personally.
that at all. I think that's amazing for a lot of people. But what I want to be doing with my days matters a lot to me. And a folder in if you take a product that has a large market, but you put it in the hands of a small production company, you can get into a situation where we have the ability to do things that we like doing on a daily basis. And it doesn't devolve into for me mainly, it's like I'm not super, my brain isn't wired well for like analytics, marketing, figuring out, how do you get a click funnel going here? How do you push the envelope of demand? I'm just a product guy, like thinking about products. And if I get to a point where we're scaling our production to a point where it's like, I don't really have to think about scaling production anymore. I have to switch to thinking about creating a demand. My brain just like short circuits. I'm like, I don't want to. And so if you can keep
You have to
yourself,
force it. Yeah, and it's
yeah, I have to
not,
force it, and I don't like that life for me. So it's like if you have a folder that has, let's say, has 10 units of demand, and it's like we're gonna make 3 units of supply, like, and that's a comfortable amount. I like the amount of employees, I like the people we have, I like doing that. It's just what we're doing. And it's like if I'd go try to crank it to 11 units of supply, now I have to, my whole game plan for what I need to do is different. I need to actually put down all the products, I need to put down the programming, and I need to go think about how do you fight the YouTube algorithm? How do you work with, you know what I mean? How do you work with Instagram mods, right? It's like I don't like getting to that point, you know what I mean?
Well, there's something else in there that I think is tied in, which a lot of our conversations are these types of concepts that like generally like outflow from one specific instance or something, so we're doing this thing with OMEP, which is the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Program. And we are doing something that I don't do in general, which is really diving into my numbers, diving into the books, looking at Shopify, breaking down our sales by product category and like how that product is made and all of these like different metrics. And as I'm doing it, I'm realizing like, oh, at the scale that we are, this is super valuable. It is also something that I would not be good at doing if I wasn't being handheld through it. You know, some of it is just like we have to let our like value show up in our business the way that it wants to. One of the where this like ties back in is like one of the concepts that Shane was really clear about was as we were looking at kind of sales data, and I'm going, wow, we like sold that much of that, and like, whoa, we only sold this much of like this product, is him telling me, listen, don't let these numbers like drive your decisions. He's like, we're never going to look at this and be like, this is the way the company needs to go because this is where the sales are. Said a lot of people will do that. That so what you're talking about would be the same thing, which is letting the demand drive your business. My sense is that demand can be really fickle. Okay. So demand is a good argument. If you're like, okay, there's demand, I'm going to make this product. But for me, letting the demand decide the course of my business isn't what I want to do. I don't want that to, I want to be able to make something that doesn't have a lot of demand. I
Which
don't ever want to get trapped.
only works if you aren't scaling production to match demand constantly.
Exactly.
Because if you end up with too much supply and not, or I mean, it doesn't matter how big you are. You can be a $100 million company and you can invest and scale and outshoot your demand. It's not like, it's not size related. And then you can end up in this position where it's like, okay, I have this manpower and these machines. I have to put them where it counts the most because we're on the periphery of what our demand can sustain. But that's a normal way to run a business. And what we are talking about is like w us as artists and as craftsmen, as people and designers, that like the business is not that for us. It's an outlet for us. You know what I mean? At its core. And it's like if you're able to have a world where you are not aggressively scaling to meet demand, you have way more flexibility. You have a bubble around you from that demand insulation where you can kind of just experiment. And so much cool stuff comes from that. And you're a testament to that because it's like you were showing me some laser stuff you did for the Halloween drop. It's like if you were always at the precipice of having too much product, you would have to have stopped and been like, is this going to sell better than this other thing? You know what I mean? But instead, you're looking at it, does that look cool? I think it looks cool. That's all there is to it, right? That's way more fun. So I've learned that. That's kind of what I'm learning.
It's the scale thing, I think right now feels very relevant to both of us. And I would guess there's a lot of guys in the industry that are experiencing or going through like similar questions, right? Whether you are whether you like identify as like a custom maker who is trying to like, you know, scale for efficiency a little bit, or you are, you know, coming at it kind of from like, you know, the like TJ, you know, maybe Grimsmo on the folder side world, where you're starting off with like a CNC, but now looking and going, okay, I can add more. Do I want to add more? I think this is just like the question of makers right now of a certain age. Dude, and it's hard.
Well, and it also depends on what are your skills, because you know, one of my best friends in the industry, Ben Peterson, he's so good playing that game that I was just describing, which is like, where are the crowds? Like, what do people like? How do you inspire people? And it's
the
like
SEO, like really digging in. I mean, he's doing all of the things naturally. It feels like the way that you and I design, or really just are involved in a different process. That's immediately who I thought about when you were talking about it.
Yeah. Earlier. And for him, like, him and I have conversations all the time. We talk regularly, and he's like, what I'm doing, he, in his words, it's like, well, it's not really how he thinks, like the looking at a machine and looking at fixtures and stuff and production processes. You know, he's more focused on the really big picture of creating like a cultural phenomena, if you will, of demand. And he's so good at it. And I'm like always so impressed by him. And what I'm doing is like forgetting all that and thinking about the product,
right?
Thinking about production efficiency and just overall engineering and stuff like that.
Right.
And so for him, an environment where like what I described is something I didn't want to do, that's actually what he wants to do. Because if he's in the reverse role where it's like, he's not able, there's no reason for him to go create this marketing giant that he has,
right?
Because he's limited in production. There's nothing for him to really try to sell, right? Like that sucks for him. So it's, nothing's universal here. It's just like, what are you good at? And furthermore, like, what do you like to do?
Yeah.
And there's models that will drive you away from doing that and towards doing that. And like, really think about that. That's where I'm at.
Yeah. This is total digression, but you and I don't spend like a ton of time doing this. Like, other than the podcast, we're not on Zoom meetings all day. We're not like in front of a computer. If we're in front of a computer, it's like active both hands, like doing a design or something like that. Dude, the entire time I've been sitting here, I've just been like fidgeting.
Oh yeah.
With a folder.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why folders are so popular.
Yeah.
Right. Like this is, so this is a Tom Crine alpha. Dude, I'm just sitting here and it's like, it's super nice. And I get that component, but like for me, knife usage has never fallen into this, but I'm also probably not going to sit here and pull my fixed blade in and out of the sheath.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know. It's like one of those things where it's like, oh, I'm just in the experience of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like if you have a manual car, it's like, if it's a really well-made manual shifter, you're sitting there like with a clutch in, you almost like just sit there and just want to put it in and out of gear. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like if it's got the right feel to it.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is from a subconscious standpoint, that it's like, the action of physical objects like that is so attractive to us.
It really is. Well, and there's like a focus, like everybody, we all know about like the fidget toy and like the concept of it, but I was just sitting there and I was basically just feeling the detent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like, as we're having a conversation, it's not distracting in any way, but it has this like worry stone quality. And I know, like, I'm sure a bunch of people listening to this are like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, because we all know that people talk about this with folders. I just haven't personally probably sat for 30 minutes on a Zoom call and just messed with a pocket knife before.
Yeah.
I also don't usually have customs that aren't mine laying around, which is maybe also plays into that. And that's super funny, man. Shout out to Tom. So we did that AK build class with Billy Cho, and Tom made us bro knives.
Dude, that's awesome.
Afterwards. And I love this thing.
Yeah, that thing's really cool. Yeah, Tom's awesome.
Yeah, you he got just, to spend a little time with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude,
yeah,
I miss Tom.
He's a really cool guy. That's a cool knife, the Alpha. That's
right.
Awesome. Yeah.
Classic. And this is like, this is another example of like, if you're coming into a folder now, right? Scalability in terms of like models, I'm really firmly situated in like the make one and then let it run for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I've done that with most of my knives. And I just, I don't know. I just like it because you get like this long time horizon, but the Alpha is one of those ones. Like it's like Tom's classic folder.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It keeps iterating on it. So there's like generations, but still
in, and in folders that's very common too, is you just see, you know, Sebenzas, Griptilians,
yeah.
you know, bug outs or whatever it is
Yeah.
where, something about a folder has a lot of staying power, it seems like.
What do you think that is? Like why, or is it just that it's more, dude, this is fun stuff, but like, yeah, is it more noticed? Arguably, like, okay, it's like buck 110. Like, how many people did that image just pop into their head for?
Yeah. And they still make that, you know, brass and wood. It weighs a metric ton, and it's, you know, technology has left it far behind. But
still,
what are the odds that someone's going to go to the store and be like, I want a knife? That's what I'm buying.
Pretty I wonder. High. Okay. I mean, fixed blades obviously have that too. But it, again, it's just a scale thing. More people are going to know probably about a buck 110 than are going to know about, I don't know, like a Gerber BMF or like some other thing that also was like very popular.
Yeah. Outside of like, you know, the Bowie knife or whatever.
Yeah. The Bowie, like you say, Bowie knife, right? Right. K-bar is probably the best example of something that instantly conjures. Like, I mean, a buck fixed blade too. It's just like, they're so ubiquitous. Did you ever have a Schrade sharp finger?
No.
Do you know what that is?
No, not on name. I might have seen it before,
you'll have to look it up. Yeah. That is one for me where it's like, it's very placed in time. It's basically a little trailing point Skinner. So like, whereas a lot of the buck, like Skinners had the like, big bulbous blade.
Oh, I see it. Yeah,
do you see it?
Yep.
So that to me is one of those, like, that's just a classic shape.
Yeah, it's got a almost a Persian kind of tip to it, but big. It's like almost a clip point but massive.
But it's a small knife
drop.
Like, dude, that as like an all-around game knife,
yeah,
was awesome. Classic. You have good belly, but you also have a fine point. Pretty fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, that was a huge sidestep, but
that's all right.
So where right now, where does this tie into our conversations around like the industry as a whole and what we're kind of seeing as trends for 2025?
Yeah, 2025. I mean, it's
not that there were any big changes in 2025 specifically, but it feels like there are things that are, I don't know, like culminating. So, okay, let me, not to interrupt you, but like, I think on the bleeding edge side of the industry, you see things there. We're seeing certain areas of the industry see things early and are kind of like forecasting and watching that. And then industry catches up and like thought processes come through, or like styles become more commonplace, or trends are slowing down that maybe like we saw like a risk point in, I guess, or like certain people in the industry saw, but now it's like people are starting to talk about it more.
Yeah.
I feel like this year I'm seeing a little more of that. Like we are hearing about like market slowdown. You know, Taylor Martin had just done like a pretty good video on some of what he's seeing around production. Right. And I would say like a lot of that are, those are like conversations that have been had for a while, but not on like a public,
not so much on the consumer side, more
not
on
so
the,
much
like,
on the consumer side, on the maker side.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the distinction right there.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know why, but it feels like this year there's maybe more of that.
Yeah, you know, I kind of wonder that what we're sensing right now is that, so in COVID, we still remember there was, you could not make a knife and it not sell
Yep.
for a while. It was literally just a frenzy.
Yeah. On a company level, like mass production,
Custom
scale level,
and
custom,
production,
anything.
everything's sold out.
Yep.
Everybody's making things as fast as they can. Everyone's
Could
hiring
not make a
everybody.
mistake.
Just outdoor industry in general. Yeah, you just could be like operating with impunity basically, and like product development and stuff. There was just a lot of freedom to do whatever because demand. And so I think we've seen like a slow ramp down from that. But I think companies and people shift their views slowly enough that we're seeing the reaction to the come down off that still. Because I know it's been enough years where it's like economically that came down ha happened a little while ago. But it's like people already had catalogs planned. People already were designing things under the conditions of that, you know, of like 2020 to 2022, 23. And they're like, that's the mindset of all the business plans that are now transpiring and designs that are now transpiring. And a lot of it isn't working anymore. And that's simply because if you're under these conditions that are artificially inflated, and you're like, holy cow, this is working good. Let's triple down, quadruple down, do this, this, this. Then it's like, okay, now that's come to fruition 36 months later. It's like, okay, wait a minute. A little bit, and myself included, it's like there's a little bit of just confidence that came from that era that may have been misplaced, where it's like, wait a minute, this is a bubble. Like it really was. It didn't burst and like calamity ensued. It was just like, it was a swell that was not going to sustain, and it did not sustain. And so I think we're just seeing like a little bit of a morass from this feeling of like, now what? You know what I mean?
And and it's a there's an organic slowdown. I always like the analogy of stopping a boat because it's like you might stop it, but that doesn't mean it stopped. And so, if companies really ramped up production, they might be sitting on product that they still have to sell, right? If it's an OEM or, and this is like where we see like the smaller like US brands that might have gone really heavy into OEM, or if you bought some machines and hired, you might be seeing that, but it's not like you just turn a switch and everything slows back down. I don't know. I feel like I'm watching and I don't feel it doesn't feel like there's been a big correction, but I hear a lot of people talking about how the market is slow. I hear a lot of customers talking about how like secondary demand is down. And when I hear that, I think in certain ways, I'm like, well, is secondary down, or was there a period of time where there was enough product made where it actually affected the demand and would have regardless? Or is there enough noise in the industry from a product standpoint that actually people just lost focus on certain areas or brands? And I mean, it's, I guess a lot of it, like we can't know. So it's a
Well,
sense,
and
gut response.
there's another thing, which is that during that COVID era, and I'm a case example of this, that was like the easiest time to start a company in a long time, where it's like I bought the Tormach just, you know, serendipitously right in the middle of that, started making fixed blades, boom, the biggest surge in knives that I've experienced in my lifetime, right when I'm starting to r ramp up production. So there was a lot of new companies that came from that filling the vacuum. And so that's part of what we're seeing now is it's like compared to 2019, there's like twice as many companies, it feels like, maybe not really, but it just seems like there's a lot of companies all of a sudden. And so
It does.
it's not just that the existing companies scaled, it's that it like the vacuums draw in new people, right? New faces. People see, people smell the vacuum for a certain type of product. Maybe other companies are out of stock, they can come in and carve out a market. And so it's a cool era in that regard, but now we're seeing like a little bit of a reformulation, because we had talked about earlier, it's like when you have a surge like that and you have a bunch of new companies, a bunch of them are going to make it, you know, a bunch of them are, I'm not saying anyone's on the precipice, but like a bunch of them are going to be around for 50 years. They're going to spend their whole life doing this. There are going to be some that like under the conditions changing aren't going to be around
Are in
forever.
and out.
And so it's it's interesting. You know what I mean? Because it's not the first time it's happened. I want to say in like 20, what was it, like 14, 15, that there was a boom kind of like that. And then it kind of fizzled around that 2015, 2016.
Dude, this is, I think it starts to blend, and I'm sure that if a company was in some of these, like even like 2008, if you're a company that affected, it's like you remember how and why. We've always been small enough. I think that we've adapted or shifted in the downtimes, right? But we talked about the concept of like fire drills before we started recording, and for me, that is like, what do you do if something in your business stops working, right? And this ties into diversification or the ability to pivot quickly. And I think it's a really important thing for makers, brands to do, right? Which is, okay, if you sell all your product to one distributor, or they're responsible for 70% of your sales, you're in a risky spot. It's the same thing with investing. It's the same, if you're a restaurant and you get all your food from one vendor, like that's a risk. If you get all your money from one sector of our industry, I see that as a risk, because that thing could have a period of time where it is not doing as well. The ability to kind of like just pivot on a just small, right? But like adapt kind of quickly. Like I used that as my, as I was trying to kind of get the Kihoku like up and running. In the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm like relying on someone else for water jet and like this. If it doesn't come, it's like, well, I can just go make a knife. Like that to me is, it's small, right? But it's a diversification.
Well,
So
and that's where a fundamental ownership over a process, it doesn't have to be the biggest process in your whole operation, but ownership over some process to the extent that it could be retooled, it could be pivoted, it could be at a low. I mean, the cost of having, say, CNC machines is high, but the cost of retooling them to make some other thing is not high. Whereas if you, like, let's say something runs aground in a product line for you and you need to hire an OEM to make some other kind of product line, that's way more risky than buying a Pearson palette and making something different. You
Just
know what I
making
mean?
something different. And a lot of these things tie into where that stress, I think for a lot of us, is actually the most beneficial development time, because you're like, I got to get this done. But it also like sparks the creativity. I don't know. I mean, I worked for, a body jewelry company when I was 17 years old, and we saw the Chinese market, the manufacturing sector got a hold of body jewelry. And what it did was flood the US market with like really high quality, really inexpensive body jewelry. So like every little kiosk in a mall that was selling barbells was buying that. When I was in originally, it was almost more like very boutique. So like if you went to a tattoo and piercing studio, they would have a Nada metal, they would have Cinequanon, they would have like, that's where Pat Pruitt got his start. Like they would have production of a high level, and then they would have custom makers at different
That's
levels.
cool.
It was, but so this business was a great kind of early lesson for me. All we made was body jewelry. We had parts that were manually made, we had screw machines. We had like they were doing the thing, right? Staff of probably, there was probably like 12, 13 people. Okay. We started to see a shift in the industry. One of the machinists came to the owner and said, hey, I know a product that we could make that would keep these machines running lights out. There's an open contract. And I might get some of the like the it's been a long time, but I want to say it was like leaded bronze 50 caliber bullets turned for like a military contract. And one of the machinists was like, he was like a long range shooter, like all just that was his, what he did when he wasn't working. Right. He's like, it's easy on our machines. We can, they're very, the tolerances are there, but they're not our tolerances. So it's an easy part for us to make.
Yeah.
And the owner was like, no, we're a body jewelry company. This is what we make. That crash kept happening. That company died within a year because a part that we were selling, like a commodity part, like what we would have been selling to a small kiosk, right? Maybe it was like a $15 barbell, internally threaded little barbell that someone would put through a piercing, right? Those started coming in from Asia for like a dollar.
Yeah. Yeah.
The diversification wasn't there. We made custom stuff that was high end that still sold, but it wasn't able to satisfy the needs of the business. The commodity side of the business got completely blown out. Just an interesting, like, obviously, like right now you see there's parallels.
Yeah.
But it was, I think a lot of my responses to certain events in the industry actually were formed by that, which I, and on my side, right? Like I saw an owner make a decision to just say, I will make one thing. And I can't say that he's wrong. Like he knew what he wanted to make and what he didn't want to make. But I realized for myself that I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that's one of those things. It's like, maybe you could call it a pride thing. You know what I mean?
Kind it of was, a, it was fully a pride thing.
Yeah. Where it's like, you know, it feels dirty to do some sort of OEM or to like, to do something like that. But it's like, well, we live in a real world where bills need paid, you know? So it's, you know,
There's nothing to say in retrospect. It's like, sure, maybe that didn't align with him, but I think for a lot of people, I think it would have sparked a larger question, which is, okay, I don't want to make that, but damn, he's
clearly,
right.
Yeah.
Like our machines are slowing down. He didn't, he just didn't take that next step.
Reading the breeze a little bit is pretty important in business in that regard. It's just like, what's the trends and how do you pivot? How do you, and in a case like that, which you've seen a similar thing with knives, it's like, I've said this before, but it's like, you can't out China. So you just got, you have to do something that doesn't,
you have to do your own thing.
You have to do your own thing. Cause you know, I don't know anything about body jewelry, but like a barbell that's round on each end, it's like, you're going to get your butt kicked on that. You know what I mean?
And I mean, and about precision, right? Like these things, that's the problem. They were good.
Yeah.
There was trash too, but there was also the companies that did it very well, you know, and this, you know, it's funny kind of tying into Best Damn EDC, kind of what he was saying, which is this, it's like, sometimes like it's the story behind it, but to me, story actually means something different because story can be fabricated, but it can also just be experience. Right. You and I were talking a little bit about early 2000s. Right. And when we look at our businesses at this point, like we can kind of see certain, I don't know, certain categories that we might fall in, but like early on, like, so we had Ernest Emerson on the podcast, right? Him, Rick Hinderer, Strider, like these companies that went from custom to production in this era of like utilizing technology that was kind of around and then building into like these really legacy brands. You know, this stuff kind of like recycles, but if you're curious, you can look back and you can see we're not making decisions in a vacuum. This is not an unknown quantity. You can see like what has helped businesses survive downturns. Like you can find that. You know?
And I think a big part of it is, like we said, there's the demand number, let's say 10 units of demand. and you're going to decide how many units of supply,
Yep.
that temptation to like try to hit that demand number exactly, where you're like,
Yeah.
I've got 10 customers that want these things. I'm going to make 10 of them.
Yeah.
If you're trying to hit that all the time,
Yeah.
all things have to do is just soften just a little bit,
A
like
little bit.
10, 10, 15%.
Yeah.
And you may not be like in trouble, but like
Right.
you're over your skis all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Whereas you have to trail it. You just have to, you know what I mean? And
Yeah.
so,
You want to leave a little juice in the apple.
yeah,
Like
exactly.
that's the.
You can't overdo it. And that's where for us, that's like, the first 3 years we were in that golden era of just like, holy cow, we bought machines, they landed coincidentally, it was COVID, boom, boom, boom. Like there was a good 3 year stretch where it was like, I had no idea what the demand was, but it could be all unlimited for all I could know, right? It was
Right.
like, it was all about production.
Yeah.
And so it's like a slight softening, and we continue to grow in demand, but my sense that it's like we can just grow, grow, grow on the production side
Right.
was like, eventually that's going to get proven wrong. And I knew that. And it's like
Right.
in 2025, it feels like it was proven wrong because we have, the business has grown from a demand standpoint, but just pedal to the metal on the supply standpoint, like eventually those paths are going to cross.
Right.
And so it's like, it's a good year in that it's, a continued growth year, but it's like now we're starting to flirt with those two lines being equal, right? And
Right.
it's like that starts to get a little bit different. And that's where I was talking about, now I have to think about things that are different than just making product. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you watch the two lines and they're playing with each other with your supply and your demand curve. And it's like, I just don't enjoy thinking about that too much. You know what I mean? And it's
Yeah.
like, so it's kind of like, don't let that happen if you can avoid
Well,
it. It's not
it
always possible,
also,
but
dude, I mean, it's just not fighting a weak position. That's
yeah.
all it is.
Yeah.
If you can do, we get to do what we want. You could be like, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm just gonna make the overland and I'm gonna make as many as I can and I'm gonna sell them. Cool. You could do that. But at a point you start fighting, you actually are now fighting to make something work. Whereas like if you add a folder, right? You still have your legacy fixed plates with all the demand that they have, and like the fact that they are very good products that stand on their own, they're good price point, like, okay. But you are not fighting to increase or scale a component of the business.
We're letting the product sort of make its own market versus making the market for the product. You know what I mean? Which is a different kind of philosophy. And I'm happy this year happened because it's like we're in great shape. We have super low overhead. That's just the way we've built it. Everything's good. But it's cool to see. It's cool to know this fact in a way that's not like a super harmful event. You know what I mean? It's like I can now see those curves intersect. And I, for 3 years, I didn't know what that was going to be like or how
Right,
that
because you
feels.
just could not
You just don't
imagine it.
know.
Yeah, you can't.
And then now you feel it and it's like, okay, I see it now. I get it. You know what I mean? And it's kind of interesting.
Dude, I mean, this stuff is so fun. I'm
Yeah.
still messing with this. Dude, it's a win, man. I'm like,
I've got a folder prototype in front of me, but I just like I'm trying to resist the urge to pick it up, and I'm not going to bring it on
mess with it.
camera. That's the thing.
Not gonna bring it on camera. Don't
Yeah.
show it.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm excited. We talked a little bit about it last week. Like I'm kind of warming up the engine for folders again. And I've been like going through old designs and like just seeing, you know what's crazy, dude, is I went into Fusion and I was like, I like some folders that are basically, I don't know,
Yeah.
70% there.
Yeah.
I completely forgot that I had them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's pretty good. Two other things I wanted to touch on. One, you have a new piece of equipment coming, and then I wanted to give you a follow-up on compressor
Yes. Yeah,
because
that
I
sounds
found
great.
something pretty interesting. So, got my quote back from Kayser. During that, the rep recommended this thing called Carefree. So check this out. Basically, you pay $2,200, and then you pay $3 per hour of air usage. And that is all. They include maintenance, which on the Kayser compressors is like not inexpensive.
So that includes the compressor as well.
So it includes, they basically wow. bring you. So I have a Kayser Air Tower 5C. Okay. Mm-hmm. Does 21 CFM at 125 PSI, 100% duty cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So it can run lights out at 21 CFM at 125. We did an air study. We're like 70% usage. So we're like the right size compressor for our mm-hmm. size of business with a yeah. little margin. Okay. So the only question that it's funny, like no one's really been able to answer this to me is our air usage, I think, is very low. I looked on my like timer and I've got like 375 hours on my compressor, which is 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me that the compressor counter is, or your timer is like counting when the motor is running or yeah. idling.
Yeah.
But not when it's just powered on.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd have to be. Yeah.
Right. So mm-hmm. if I had to pay $3 an hour for a 40-hour work week or 50-hour or whatever it is, that's a lot different than paying. They have a minimum of 40 hours per month. Mm. What it sounds like is I'm under 40 hours a month.
So okay? flat rate essentially.
So becomes... flat rate. So it's yeah. really interesting because what they did was they turned air into like a utility. A
utility, yeah.
As opposed to a capital, it's like a natural like gas outlet. Bill. Yeah. yeah. So the way that it would look it's is you pay your $2,200 startup fee, and then $120 a month.
I find 40 that very hours. Interesting.
I know. So I will. Yeah, I'll send you the link. I immediately thought of you. I still struggle because I'm like, man, I like owning my equipment.
Right.
But this is a piece of equipment that actually it's not a CNC mill. It's not yeah. like something super sexy. It is air.
Yeah.
And the fact that so the 2200 startup fee, we kind of ran the numbers. It's like for a year contract at 40 hours with the 2200, it might be like $260 a month.
Mm-hmm.
But because the service is included, even at our scale, it's like service is probably once every 2 years. Mm-hmm. A service is expensive, like $1,800. It's included. Yeah. And they have an insurance. They have a downtime insurance policy that's included up to $250 an hour. So if you are without air wow. for any reason, it's covered.
That's crazy. That's super. That has me very intrigued.
I thought it might.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for like for a lot of you guys too, like I cannot speak highly enough about the Kayser air towers in a small yeah. shop because they're like 67 or 70 decibels.
Yeah.
And you get clean and dry air.
Yeah.
But they are freaking expensive. The unit I'm looking at is 13 grand.
Yeah. Like, and then the servicing and
it's expensive.
Compressors break down. They just do.
Yeah. Yeah. They do. Right. Yeah. So, there's that. Still don't know what I'm going to do. I'm waiting on the final. If they tell me like, yeah, you've used 370 hours over the last 3 years, I'll 100% do it. Yeah. If they tell me they're going to charge me, you know, $3 at 40 hours yeah, a week.
On time
versus runtime. I'm
yeah,
out.
That's a problem.
Right.
Yeah. I was thinking that same thing. I was like, yeah, 40. I was like, ooh, that's a lot. And then, yeah, dude, I like that a lot. I like that.
I know.
I want to do
I know.
That. yeah.
I'm trying. Yeah. This is an area of like business and scaling that I'm now having to kind of look at some of my preconceived notions and tendencies, which is like, I just buy the machine. I own the machine. And it's like, no, I want to own the process. But I guess in this case, like if the offset is there, like, you know, 1 year, it's like, I could decide I need to buy one in a year, but I could also decide I need a bigger machine
and
swap it out.
The other thing is like, you can always do the ROI where it's like, okay, if I spent the 13 grand plus the 1800 a year or 2 years, whatever to service it, you could find out like the horizon where the where it becomes cheaper.
Dude, and I'm terrible about doing that stuff.
You have to factor in like the time cost of money, right? Because
Right.
if you put 14, 15 grand into an air compressor,
Yeah.
that's 14, 15 grand that you didn't spend on what?
Yeah.
On a product. You know
Exactly.
what I mean?
Even
And
finance. So this
so.
is another one. Kayser right now, dude, they'll do 0% at 36 months. So the time cost of the money is a little bit different because in 3 years I would own it, but I also own the fact that then I pay for service. And I mean, dude, like with margins, like in cash flow is usually our biggest issue at this point, is like we spend money in big chunks and then make money in small chunks a lot of times. You know, the difference between $120 a month or $350 a month might actually be enough of a deciding factor. Because that $200 a month could actually be another machine payment that is like doing another process
Yeah, that more directly makes money or
more
whatever it is.
directly makes
Yeah.
money.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these are the fun games. What was the equipment that you just got?
Yeah, so we purchased a whole Cerakote setup. Steven's working
Okay.
for us. He's a certified Cerakote applicator. We've been needing to upgrade the oven.
Yep.
So what we've had has been kind of a DIY thing that was it was another Cerakoters that gave it to Steven, and Steven's had it, and then now we're just upgrading the oven. And so we ordered a what's the name? It's I forget the name of the company actually now, though, but it's if you Google like Cerakote oven,
Is
it's
it the
like
big silver box? Is it
yes,
like the silver box ones? Okay.
yeah. The big company, they make freaking giant it's powder coating, like
So
big enough to put
how big of an oven did you get?
So it's 24. The inside dimensions are like 24 by 24 by 5 feet tall.
Oh, wow. It's like
So
a refrigerator.
you're talking like smallish fridge. Yeah.
What
And
did that set you back?
the delivered, and we had a couple options on it. So one of the things is with Cerakote, you have to be mindful, especially with Magnica, on your temps in there because you can achieve temperatures easily.
Whoa, what?
I mean, the peak temperature on one of those is like 450 degrees.
Oh,
And
wow.
and so because they're powder coat ovens, which powder coat needs like 400 plus degrees, and Cerakote doesn't. You only need like it's time. It's the hotter it is, the faster it works.
Okay.
So it depends on the soak time. But with our MagnaCut, I mean, our temperature is like 325 or something. So you got to be very mindful of that, and it you could set the unit up and say like okay up 275, but you're not guaranteed that some of the knives are not going to be closer to the element and actually
Right.
exceed that, and
Okay.
so we upgraded it with a fan system
Yeah.
that circulates that creates an induction so that you don't because in a lot of applications it wouldn't matter, but with knives like that I think it matters quite a bit. So anyway. With the features we picked, about delivered, which is a big part of it, 2,300 or 2,400 bucks,
Okay.
and
That seems very
500
reasonable.
of that is shipping.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is rough, but
What do you think? I keep looking at our shop and I'm trying to figure out where Cerakote's going to go. What do you think like minimum space for a functional Cerakote area is?
So the oven could be very small.
Yeah.
That's like a low requirement deal. But
But I
the
want to be
paint,
able to put rifles in it
yeah,
also.
right, yeah. Well, the paint booth, and I'm not the expert to speak on this. I'm
Yeah.
not the certified applicator, but the paint booth is a big deal.
Yeah.
And that what I mean by that is a lot of guys will just set up like a hood, and they'll
Yeah.
just paint like an open environment where it's just a hood behind it.
Yep.
You're gonna get contamination. You're gonna have issues. You really need a fully enclosed booth that has basically the way Steven has set it up is he's got a giant fan on the outside of the back of the booth, drawing air out of the paint zone, going through filters, and then it ports outside and just ejects the air
Okay.
outside.
Is there
But
any smell like coming out, or
no,
is the
not.
filtration very good? 'Cause it is a, it's not like a, it's not a, what, like a vapor or an aerosol. It is a powder,
No, it's not a
right?
powder. It's
It's
wet.
not.
It's
It
paint.
is. Okay. It is wet.
Yeah,
Okay.
it's wet. And so the big thing though is he's got filters behind him so that the air being drawn
coming
in is filtered. It crosses past him, past the part, takes all of the overspray and goes out the back. So you're creating a, like a slow-mo wind tunnel.
Yeah.
And if you don't have...
What is that called? Like a positive charge or something? It's something like that, right? Or like negatively charged maybe. Room.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you don't have... A lot of the boosts have the fan and the filter behind the part. And the only reason is to pick up all the overspray.
Right.
But what's going to happen is the fan is going to draw just all the contamination from the room into the parts. And
super interesting.
So the reason I'm familiar with that is we had... Back when I was just hiring him as a contractor and we weren't even in this shop, we were having issues with the specs. And he found out that he pretty frequently has to vacuum all the walls inside there because the fan can kick on and draw particulate from the walls.
Yeah.
And it'll come straight to your part. And so, yeah. So it's like if you don't have a booth that has filters behind and in front of you that's clean, you're going to have contamination. You're going to get hairs
on
it.
How big is that booth?
So his is oversized for like just pure
knives.
Because
you have space, yeah.
But it's probably 4x8, and it's the long way. So he's spraying into the back of it.
Okay.
So it's a lot of room to move around. I think you could probably get away with, 3x6 or 4x6. I don't know. But like, to do it that way and to not get contamination, yeah, it's going to be hard.
I was thinking about, so our shop now, we have a kitchen and shower in it. Mm-hmm. And I was actually thinking about maybe decommissioning that and then making that a paint room because it's got a door. It can close. Yeah. It's like, it's got wiring for whatever it is. So I might do that. But in that room is probably like 10 by 10. So that would be plenty of space.
Yeah. Let me look up the Light Armor ovens. That's where I bought it. Ovens. So they do make, I was looking at their booths. So they have, let's see, I'm looking at their booths real quick. So they can make a booth that's like, say 4x4x6, which would be kind of like what I was just describing.
Yeah.
It's like $2,000. And it's a metal booth that has lights built in with the fan and everything. So that's kind of an
interesting. Light Armor booths.
Light Armor. And they have really good reviews. That's where we ordered the oven.
Okay.
And they've got booths all the way up to like putting an automotive frame in there.
Yeah.
16
That's
feet
a
long.
Pretty, that's a pretty, we also have the side room of the shop. Just so funny. I feel ridiculous in my shop right now. Oh, here's just, this one is an interesting one from a realization standpoint. And plans. Okay. When I started to set up the new shop, 100%, I thought I'm going to put the machines over there and I will be able to have an employee over there run the machines. So far, it's 100% reversed. I am over there. Employees are in the shop here. And I think that is actually going to stay that way for a long time.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah.
I think it's because it's just where the shop is in process. I can't put someone in there.
It's the new though. Yeah.
I can't put someone in there and have them develop it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have to develop it before I place a person.
Right.
The only thing that's been nice about that is like when the machine is running, there's literally nothing else that I can do. So I'm just bringing my laptop and doing design work.
Oh yeah.
But that if I put someone else in running the machine, that's like,
you'd
literally just be running parts
and
then sitting there for 15 minutes and then changing those parts. So just an interesting like reframe. Like I think a lot of times we get pretty close with our plans or like estimations, but very rarely is it 100%. And sometimes they're like real, like that's a real shift.
Yeah,
the plan still worked, but it just wasn't like, oh, it's backwards.
Right. Yeah, that's it is really funny how that works. And that's where like the intentionality of what you want to be doing matters so much.
Yeah,
is like there's this way that like you fall into slots in your own business
without realizing it.
Yeah. And you think that you're free because you run the business, but you can easily end up spending a long stretch of time doing something where it's like, why am I trapped by this? Right. Like what I created this for me to be here. Like, that's kind of odd. but you have to kind of wake yourself up sometimes to that.
That's a check-in thing. Like, I'm trying to be better about like looking at things even on like a quarterly basis and just being like, okay, is this the right direction? Are we like, are we being reactive to everything, or are we actually like making progress towards like a larger goal? And the funny thing is, a lot of times I don't have some overarching goal, but if I look at a situation, I can tell if I'm making progress.
Yeah.
And the progress or the ability to make a change or like to pursue like a short-term goal is, I think that's important to me. Mm-hmm, like maybe that's my goal, you know?
Yeah.
Dude, that was a fun talk.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
Should we wrap it?
Yeah, I think so.
Feel I like mean, that natural, was, natural that was stopping solid. Point?
It is Halloween. We got to go maybe finish up some Halloween costumes for this evening. Nice. So
send me pictures of the costumes, man. I'll do the same. What Wilson, a, it really is great.
Wilson wanted to be a piece of pizza. And he's been on that for like 2 months. No, has not changed his opinion. He's 3 years old. He's like, I want to be a piece of pizza.
That's amazing. Yeah,
committed. So we're making him into a piece of pizza.
Dude, what about Delta?
She wants to be a cat.
Okay.
So that was a little simpler, but yeah.
Dude, pretty solid. I'll send you our kids. Our Bo did the Invisible Man. It's actually great because it's all for him. It's like all body humor because he doesn't have a face. So it's like all in like his hands.
Yeah.
And then Winston wanted to be a vampire. And it's potentially my favorite thing ever because he's got this long curly hair. Dude, it's like classic Interview with a Vampire, like ponytail. Like, oh, dude, I love it. It's so good.
That's great. I love it.
And they both did Taekwondo yesterday in their costumes. And it was hilarious.
That's awesome.
Like little vampire, like kicking mitts.
Yeah. So. Dude, yeah. Halloween's is so good for that age. I mean,
dude,
the whole dress up thing. I mean, you go for me at least to go through those, like that couple of decades where Halloween really falls off as a holiday.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Cause it's like,
it's like teen years. Like maybe you're still going out and like causing trouble.
Yeah.
And then that turns into like maybe parties, and then you go college and it's parties.
Yeah.
But like the,
for the like mid-level adult, it's kind of just like whatever.
Yeah. Once you're out of like going to fun Halloween parties and or going out yourself, dude, it's
but now it's back.
I always take a big thermos of hot cider with whiskey in it. And I just walk around and I love it.
Brilliant.
And yeah, there's the hack.
That is a hack.
All right, dude. Well, have fun. Be safe, guys. Be safe out there. You're not going to hear this on Halloween, but hopefully everybody has a good holiday.
Yep. Brush your teeth.
Brush your teeth. Do some fire drills. Look at your business. Figure it out.
Good times.
Peace. See you guys.